This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in German Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Leah Greenberg. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Annegret Oehme about her book, The Night Without Boundaries, Yiddish and German Arthurian Wiegeleus Adaptations, coming out this month with Brill. Welcome to the podcast, and thank you so much for joining us, Annegret.
Thank you so much for having me.
So before we get started, a little bit about our guest today. Annegret Oehme is currently an assistant professor in the German Studies Department at the University of Washington, Seattle. She received her PhD in 2016 in German from Duke University and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill through the Carolina Duke Graduate Program in German Studies. So we're both fellow graduates of this program, I'm very excited to say. Her research interests include medieval and early modern German and Yiddish literature and pre-modern cultural transfers within a German-Jewish context. Her publications on old Yiddish literature, early modern marriage treatises, and a graphic novel have appeared in publications such as the German Quarterly, Ashkenaz, Daphnis, and Arthuriana, among other journals. Her short-form monograph, He Should Have Listened to His Wife, from De Gruyter in 2020, explores female agency in Middle High German and Yiddish Arthurian romance. She has two books coming up, not just one. Medieval Jewish Romance, a volume she's co-edited with Caroline Grunbaum, and her monograph, The Night Without Boundaries, Yiddish and German Arthurian Wiegeleus Adaptations, which, as I mentioned, is scheduled to come out this month. So before we get into the meat of our discussion about today's book, Annegret, I'd first like to ask you a bit about yourself. Could you tell us a little bit about what brought you to German studies, what brought you to medieval and early modern literature, what brought you to Old Yiddish, what brought you to Seattle and to North Carolina as well?
Thank you. Thank you for the kind introduction. I think getting to this point in my research was sort of a series of incidents, really. I started my bachelor's at the Freie Universität Berlin in journalism, actually, and Jewish studies as a minor, big plan becoming a journalist later. And I hated journalism. I hated the classes. It was just terrible. And somebody told me, well, I mean, you could just do a bachelor's in German studies, right? That's the classic gateway for Germans and to become journalists and work in media. And I was like, well, okay, that sounds good. And I took an Arthurian class, a class on Arthurian literature that was just utterly fascinating. The professor, Annette Gerock-Reiter, was so excited about that literature. So a real nerd, you know, loving what she was teaching. I was like, these medieval texts are really fascinating. So I took more classes, one thing led to the other. In Jewish studies, I took Yiddish also out of interest, really no specific reason. I was just like, yeah, Yiddish. I know some Yiddish songs. I would love to take a Yiddish class. And then I was really, at some point, I decided to do my master's in medieval German literature. And I had this strange incident. I remember, you know, where I was sitting, sort of the revelation at the library at the Freie Universität Berlin, working on a paper for actually a very traditional Middle High German text, Wolfram's Parsifal, Wolfram von Eschenbach. But somehow in one of the articles, there was a footnote on old Yiddish literature. And I was like, what's old Yiddish literature? When is old Yiddish literature? Is this pre-19th century even? And it just happened that at this point, somebody was selling, one of my colleagues or like fellow students was selling a book, Introduction to Old Yiddish Literature. And I was like, yes, I need that book. So I read this book from cover to cover, and it was really this revelation. It was like this incident when you have the map and there's this white spot, the undiscovered country right on the map. I'm sorry if these are sort of almost colonialist metaphors. But for me, it was really, it suddenly filled in a gap where I had no idea about, well, of course there are texts, sort of non-religious texts in the 15th, 16th, 17th century among Jews. Why wouldn't there be? And just reading about them was a big revelation. And I started actually my path towards a dissertation with another text, a so-called love and an adventure novel. It's a contested genre, but it goes back to antiquity, about two lovers falling in love, losing each other, and at the end finding each other again. It turned into a great, into an article that I'm still grateful for. But then I came across, well, Vido Wild, and we just had to spend several years together to get to know each other better. And this led then to several articles and, as I always say, 1.5 books with the short form monograph, right? Yeah.
So you've told us a little bit about what brought you then to this book project, but I wanted to go back to what you mentioned. You said you already knew some Yiddish songs. So how does a young Annegret in Zwickau come to learn Yiddish songs?
So I actually went after my Abitur to Israel for a year. I volunteered there in a house for Shoah survivors. And a lot of those people would still know some Yiddish. There were lots of former Eastern European Jews. And they, of course, the Yiddish speakers just thought, well, you know German, right? So you know Yiddish. Which was funny because, well, there's a big gap between understanding Yiddish and understanding German. Not so much for the earlier stages, but perhaps we'll get into that later. But for modern Yiddish, there's a big difference. But so I knew some Yiddish music. I was at some point also the choir leader for this house. We had Friday evenings or Shabbat gatherings, and I played the guitar and conducted the choir in a very quirky, low-key way. But and we did Hebrew songs, we did Yiddish songs. So I liked the music and I liked the sound of the language of Yiddish. So that's why when I saw the Yiddish classes offered, I thought, yeah, of course, let's take a Yiddish class. The Yiddish classes, however, were really interestingly conceptualized. We're probably going to talk about this later, but a part of my book is also a 1699 Yiddish teaching book by Johann Christoph Wagenseil, a Protestant and philosopher and Orientalist at University of Nuremberg back in the days, or at a sub-university of University of Nuremberg. And he wrote a book that was mostly learning by doing, by translating Yiddish texts into German, or the other way around, people would learn. And that's what very much was going on in early 2000s Yiddish classes in Berlin, that we would just read the Yiddish foreword or things like this and just make our way along those texts. So when I started learning Yiddish, I completely was missing sort of grammatical structures in this because it was, well, it's just like German. So let's just together read it and figure out with a dictionary at hand what the words mean.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, you do mention some of the important entanglements between German and Yiddish. And then you go further back looking at Old Yiddish, which is also a very different arena than looking at more modern Yiddish texts. So could you maybe then lay out for us then, you know, you mentioned how you came to your book project. What is the sort of thesis of your book? What are the key stories and texts that you're working with, and why are you talking about them together?
Yeah, in order to sort of explain the larger thesis of the book, I should add one more thing, and that is that the Yiddish Widuwild is actually based on a Middle High German text from around 1210, 1220. It's called Viga Lois, Middle High German Arthurian Romance. And the Yiddish text is an adaptation of that text. And from there, we have many adaptations. We have a really rich tradition of German Yiddish texts that go back and forth. At some point, the tradition gets mediated through this Yiddish textbook that I mentioned from the end of the 17th century and creates this rich tradition of texts that inspire each other, that cross a lot of boundaries, linguistic, temporal, religious, cultural boundaries. And the aim of the book is to show that we can't really understand these texts separately. We have to see them in the larger context without emphasizing a Jewish, a Yiddish, a Christian German tradition. Because first of all, those terms don't apply throughout the whole time, and they're just incredibly restrictive. And I think that that's also what led me to this project, a little bit the frustration that the Yiddish texts would be explored by some Jewish studies scholars, barely by German studies, and the other way around, of course. So I think in order to really understand this tradition, the fascination of Vigalois or Widuwild, how he's called in Yiddish, through, you know, more than 800 years, we need to see this as a shared story, as a shared narrative tradition in which people contribute at different times with very different intentions, consciously, unconsciously, knowing about all the adaptations, not knowing about more than one adaptation to this tradition, and then creating sort of a whole thing that goes back and forth. And that really sort of shows that this quirky knight called Widuwild is overcoming all these boundaries and restrictions. And restrictions that we would expect, for example, from an Arthurian knight, if you consider King Arthur also as a sort of Christian figure, messianic figure.
And so just to give some temporal boundaries or put in place exactly what time period we're talking about when we talk about the emergence of the Vigalois story. Can you give us a sense of when and where we first find these texts?
Mm-hmm. So Vigalois itself is debated. It uses some old French material, potentially. Some people consider it actually an adaptation of it. Some people say, like, oh, it's just using some elements from another story, Le Belle Inconnue. And basically, early 13th century, we have this Middle High German Arthurian Romance. In general, early 13th century is a great time, sort of end of 12th century for Arthurian stories in a German context. We have first Old French stories, and they make it quickly into Middle High German adaptations. So they are very popular at the court, you know, narrating Arthurian stories at this time. So Vigalois, and we'll probably talk about Vigalois a little bit more later, but Vigalois itself is a sort of classic, in a sense, Arthurian tale. But then it's already a big question and something that medievalists are used to, or early modernists. Then at some point we have those 16th century manuscripts. We have three Yiddish manuscripts. We're skipping 300 years here. That clearly show an engagement. It's a Vigalois adaptation. There's no doubt about this. And the question is, what's in between? Is there anything in between? Did the adapter actually know Vega Lois? Did the adapter know some of the prose adaptations of Vega Lois or other in between texts? I think the question is that sometimes a little bit, it's not necessarily always fruitful to try to reconstruct what's in between. I think at this point we have to accept Vega Lois as a Vega Lois adaptation and see, well, how do they interact and have Vega Lois as a reference. So we can't, of course, study the line by line. We can't study as a line by line comparison, but we can look at sort of like general tendencies that are different. And there's a lot of differences between Vega Lois and Vega Lois. It's just left open what happens and at what point does it happen? Is it really who creates the Vega Lois? And as I said, we already have three manuscripts, which shows, okay, at some point we have the story in Yiddish. We have the manuscripts that are likely from Northern Italy, which is actually not uncommon for Yiddish at this point, but it's unclear how old the story of Widuwild then really is, this adaptation. Is it 100 years old? Is it 200 years older? I think that's the most that scholars want to push it, sort of 200 years. And then we have even in that sort of Vega Lois Widuwild tradition, a print from the late 17th century that actually gets adapted then into the Yiddish teaching book. And so the print itself is then already fascinating, almost more than the manuscripts. Often enough, they are just folded into a Yiddish Widuwild. Sometimes they're just referenced as such in scholarship without differentiating, but there's also quite some difference between the manuscript and the print, the late 17th century print.
So in all of this, adaptation is a very key term, and you also work with the framework of adaptation studies. So I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more also how you look critically at the terms adaptation, retelling, translation.
That was, I think, one of the biggest issues I had when working on this. So what do I call those things? I can see there's a relation between those texts, but how do we call them? So at some point, I went down the rabbit hole, reading a lot on translation. Even Benjamin, the translator, historic approaches to medieval Latin translations, then in a medieval German context, of course, the words for retelling, Weitererzählen or Wiedererzählen, are also central concepts. There, several scholars have worked on these. And eventually I realized that the word adaptation, also in German, Adaption, is something that just keeps popping up, even in the very strongly argued papers on no, translation is not the word to use for medieval studies. We should use retelling or text it to the opposite. It's interesting that people often go back to call those texts adaptations and not Weitererzählungen, like retellings or things like this. In the context of translations is, of course, slightly different. But then I realized that there's actually a whole adaptation theory. Unfortunately, it's a modern theory that came about through studying the relationship of books and movies. So how do movies relate to books? And scholars developed this theory, often considering, or one of the classic definitions would be considering adaptation an extended, deliberate revisitation of a work of art, of a specific work of art. And that became sort of a working term that I found very useful. What I really like about the adaptation studies field is that despite being mostly English studies people who do film book relations, it allows for reflections on a democratization of the field. So without reconstructing, oh, what's the real? That's the book is, of course, the real deal, right? And then we have the movies and they're just movies. They're not as good. So it goes away from putting a value, a validation also on sort of the first part of an adaptation tradition. And it also stresses that there can be different entry points. And we're probably talking later about the comic. There's a comic, a Vigalois comic. And the Vigalois comic really plays with the idea that people might have never heard about Vigalois and read the comic first and potentially then go and read the book. Or that they are, well, scholars and nerds like me who are like, oh, there's a comic about Vigalois. That's so great. I should read that. And get to the comic, however, from, for example, Wern von Grafenberg's Vigalois from the 13th century. So we have different approaches, and then we read the adaptations differently. So for a person who started with the comic and then reads the Middle High German text in translation, of course, the reference point is a comic. For me, the reference point, even though I try to work against this, but still the inherent reference point would then be the Vigalois text from the 13th century. And adaptation studies really stresses that there are different entry points into adaptation traditions that really form how an audience receives one text or the other. And in the field of medieval German studies and really German studies in its early forms, there was this search for an original, reconstructing through different manuscript the original of a text. And people have hence gone away from this for various reasons. Often it's just futile and we just have too little information, but also because there are deliberate changes in manuscripts often enough that are not just mistakes. We have mistakes, you know, like a tired monk. It's late, it's dark, there's just one candle. Well, you make a mistake. But we also have deliberate changes. Most famously in the Nibelung tradition, we have two different manuscript editions that sort of blame different people for the downfall of the Nibelungen. And so when I saw adaptation studies and the way they approach it, I thought, oh, but a lot of those things are actually fairly medieval or common in medieval studies. This not stressing of that's the original, that's the first iteration, that's really the core iteration of a story. And that's how I found adaptation studies fairly liberating and also useful in just looking at those different texts, especially when often enough I don't 100% know what is the exact reference. Sometimes I know, sometimes an author, an adapter tells us, it's like, oh, this is what I read. Sometimes we don't know. And then it's also hard to reconstruct the exact relationship.
Mm-hmm. And then going to one of the texts that serve as a jumping off point then for its later iterations is then Wien's Vigalois story that you talk about in one of your early chapters. So I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more about how this story deals with boundaries and the crossing of boundaries, the representation of Christian and non-Christian figures, for example.
Vigalois is a fascinating text that was first dismissed among early scholars for just being too strange, too weird. It has a lot of apocalyptic imagery. It's a classic Arthurian tale in the sense that we have one of King Arthur's knights of the Table Round, Vigalois, who rides out on a quest, on adventure. In this case, he frees an enchanted kingdom and returns home now with a bride, convenient, and is later reinstated as king of his own kingdom. However, there's a whole second part, and I'll come to this in a second, that makes it a very strange text. But already sort of early scholarship said, this is so full, so ripe of not even religious imagery, but sort of magical, mystical images. This is just weird. Let's read another text. Mm-hmm. And so that's one thing that clearly Vigalois does. He brings together strictly Christian religious and not strictly Christian religious imagery. I think when we have issues with seeing this in the text, we also have to ask ourselves what sort of like Christian concept do we have? And there, by this point, a lot of studies on also questioning sort of what's the medieval courtly God? What's medieval Christianity? It's not our sort of Protestantized form of religion anymore. And I must say, I struggle with the text or with the boundaries between sort of Christian imagery and general sort of supernatural images initially. But then I went to Peru for the first time. And fun fact, and it was so interesting seeing religion in Peru. That's so different for somebody who grew up in sort of, again, a Protestantized universe in Germany. I was like, oh, well, there are a lot of magical things that they're doing. I had our host was very kind and offered me sort of a blessing. I wanted to do something nice for me. And so I got to at a marketplace, hold a horseshoe, put my hand in the horseshoe. I was supposed to make a wish on this horseshoe. There were images of Mary. And the person who was giving the blessing basically took my hand with the horseshoe over incense and uttered a prayer to the Virgin Mary. I was like, oh, wow, just wow. This was a mix of things that, I don't know, my upbringing would have considered clearly not religious and things that are inherently Christian. So that helped me also approach this text differently and think like, well, maybe we put on those categories. This is supernatural, non-Christian, this is Christian. That just weren't a problem for the audience then, but maybe for the 19th century readers. So this is a big boundary that the text crosses. Further, as I said, it has a whole second part after Vigelois happily is united with his sweetheart, formerly damsel in distress, heiress to the enchanted country. Because another lord, he's approached to help another lord who is currently besieged. There's a whole battle. And the second half, or the last third of the text, is just epic battles. That a lot of people don't consider Arthurian, not being part of Arthurian romances, medieval Arthurian romances. The discussions, was it added later? Was it not? What can we do with that? And interestingly, it's not just scholars who were confused by that. The early adapters all were. So already in the Widuwild, this whole battle, epic battle section is completely cut. In the early New High German prints and adaptations, this is cut. So beyond sort of Vigelois, beyond Wernd of Graffenberg, nobody really knew what to do with that. But I actually argue in the book that it's a fascinating section of the book in which Wernd actually experiments with the boundaries of Arthurian romance and brings in different traditions. So already Middle Ages had sort of ideas of different story traditions. Already in the 12th century, we have an old French poet talking about basically one story box, stories pertaining to antiquity, one stories pertaining to King Arthur and his knights, and one pertaining to Charlemagne and Charlemagne's fights against the heathens. And so what Wernd does is actually use the Arthurian story and bring in these antiquity stories and the stories concerning Charlemagne and the heathens. And so I consider it a huge literary experiment that Wernd constructs here that, again, didn't go down well, apparently, with audiences. The text was very popular, Vigelois itself, but with later audiences, already sort of 15th, 16th century, that said, no, let's just make it a straightforward Arthurian tale. This is strange. Let's just cut it. But so he also plays with literary expectations, with literary traditions, by bringing in Amazons, for example, so classic antiquity features, or heathens, very courtly heathens. This is something that we often associate with Wolfram von Eschenbach's Villaheim, the heathens that are mirrored according to the courtly sort of Christian knights. And so we have all of this, however, in an Arthurian romance here. So he's also crossing a lot of boundaries from in sort of a narratological way and just bringing in different story traditions.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So also when you talk about the Yiddish version of this text, the Widuvut story, you also talk about how it sometimes subverts our expectations of a text that engages with religious topics. So I was wondering if you could tell us also a bit more about how the Widuvut story goes beyond an engagement with Jewish topics and why it's important to think about it beyond sort of a Christian-Jewish divide.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. This is a great question. This is actually how I got started on this whole topic or got interested, because a lot of scholarship focuses, and rightly so, on the question that you just asked, how are Christian elements dealt with in this text. This is presumably for a Jewish audience, although we can also debate this a little bit because the Old Yiddish is so close to German that if it's read out, people would understand it without issue. So German speakers, so there's also a little bit of debate here. But if we assume for a moment a Jewish audience as a target audience, then that's a good question to ask, right? How do you get away from this immense Christian imagery, and we have even God acting on behalf of Vigalois within Wilhelm's Vigalois. So and he's praying, there's Christian, really inherently Christian imagery. So something needs to happen on the way to the Jewish audience. And these were the questions that were first asked in scholarship. And one of the things that we certainly see is this so-called de-Christianization. And we have a few Jewish elements, but what I found really interesting when I read scholarship and read text, I thought, but things like Pentecost, for example, remain in the text. Pentecost is, of course, the Feast of the Holy Spirit, one of the, especially in the Middle Ages, core Christian events on the calendar. Why is this in a Yiddish text? Why would this remain in a text with a Jewish audience in mind? And one of the reasons that I think is that Pentecost is just a huge courtly feast. So it's just been synonymous for, okay, there's a party at the court going on, and it's a big one, and it's a long one. You might have people being knighted in the context of Pentecost celebrations, but certainly it's a big court date. It's a big court feasting date. So when we see this, we assume that the Jewish audience was able to decipher that and said, oh, Pentecost. Yeah, of course. That means at King Arthur's court, there was a huge party going on, or this is the season of festivity, of joyfulness, of courtly joy. So this is one of the things that that is interesting then to look when we think, oh, why are there some Christian elements left in that? Because it assumes some sort of familiarity, if we take this further, with the material or with the expectations of the material. And otherwise, the text is just not really concerned with the religious elements that Vigalois is concerned with or Wernd is concerned with. It turns it more into a actually funny text, but sometimes I get actually frustrated by the constant sort of looking for Jewish and Christian elements in the text, because when I started working on this project and read Widuvut, I thought, hey, the big change here is that suddenly women are put in important positions of power. And that's what my first small book was about, the women in Widowwild. And it's just so in your face how the gender roles are inverted and changed. But at the same time, it was almost completely ignored in scholarship. And I mean, I'm able also to do what I'm doing because there has been scholarship, right? So I'm deeply indebted to the people who've worked on Widowwild, who made it more popular and who already took care of the whole Christian-Jewish discussions. But I was frustrated that somehow this whole clear change in the storytelling was lost in the discussions because we were so focused on sort of drawing those Christian, Jewish, Yiddish, German boundaries, which is one thing that I really tried to work against by deciding to put in my book different texts from different religious, cultural, different linguistic, different lingual backgrounds. So I'm sorry that I almost criticized you for the question. So I just want to make a point that it is a good and it's an important question as long as it doesn't get, or as long as it doesn't bury the actual text and the actual text tradition and seeing like, oh, well, let's just look at the text. And here's where adaptation studies comes in sort of like freeing us to look at an artwork also as the artwork itself, as the adaptation. So there's this three-partite concept of adaptation as sort of a reiteration of a text, as an artwork itself, and as sort of like a future entrance point into adaptation studies. And I really like, especially in the context of Widowwild, also stressing this stepping back for a moment and really seeing the text as the text itself. What happens here in the storyline? How are women constructed? How's the night constructed? Before just looking, okay, we know this is a adaptation for a Yiddish-speaking audience. How is it different than the text before it?
Mm-hmm. And you bring up the issue of not just adaptations of stories, but also of reception and different contexts of retelling. And so in your fourth chapter, when you talk about Johann Christoph Wagenseil, that's another example of a new context in the late 17th century of retelling Yiddish material. So I was wondering if you could tell us more about what that context is in terms of the discourses on language and nationalism in this time, and why was this author even engaging with Yiddish material?
Yeah, that's a great question. Wagenseil actually does not think that Yiddish is a great language. He doesn't even consider it a language. So great motivation to write a Yiddish teaching book. He considers it bad German. There are some very harsh quotes in the text in Wagenseil, what the Jews have done to good German in order sort of to get to Yiddish. And so it's a very strange place to find a Yiddish author in Romans. Also, it's a very long text. But basically, what Wagenseil does, as I mentioned earlier, he has a textbook in which he gives a very brief introduction to the structure of Yiddish, an extremely long introduction concerning his thoughts about Yiddish, about German, his ideas of language, and then has a long list of exercises, really translation exercises. There are also Talmudic stories, legal texts. It's an incredibly strange mix of texts. And that Yiddish, that the Widowwild is in there is fascinating and strange. Wagenseil also offers us an introduction, and that goes a little bit in your direction of national traditions, because in his introduction to Widowwild, he explains to his audience, who likely did not know Arthur at this point. So I should have said King Arthur stories were not really popular in 16th, 17th century, early 18th century Germany. And so he explains, so there's this King Arthur, bear with me for a second. The English believe in them. They also think he comes back at some point. How crazy is that? But that's their story tradition. And we Germans, we have heroic epics, right? We have Dietrich von Bern. We have the big heroes around Charlemagne and everybody. This is our story tradition. Now come in the Jews. And the Jews had this funny idea of mixing them together and created this author story. And he explains actually the existence of some fantastic literatures that, well, we know were part of the medieval or middle-high German tradition, with the existence of the English Arthurian story. So he doesn't, Wagenseer doesn't really know about Arthurian stories, has no idea about Wiegalois. But he explains, well, the Jews took those Arthurian stories and mixed in our heroic epics, and this is what we get. A really quirky story, interesting, fascinating, or no, he doesn't really fascinate, but like, he's like, yeah, so here we are. I think he also just had some fun reading the text, because part of his argument in the book is that Yiddish texts can also be quite interesting. They're not, even though he doesn't like the language itself, but he says, you know, some of them are just really entertaining to read. And I think that's where Wiedewald falls in. Mm-hmm. But as I said, Yiddish is not his favorite language. Again, not even a language for him, and not considered a language for a long time. But Hebrew is great. Hebrew, Wagenseer loves Hebrew. He comes out of the tradition of the humanist movement, the Christian humanist movement, with their goal, ad fontes, to the sources, let's learn Hebrew. And Yiddish, basically for Wagenseer, is just a gateway to Hebrew. There's some other reasons also, sort of one of his secondary audiences are actually Jews, because he said, well, they should learn good German, but nobody's taking care of that. So here's my book. So if you're a Yiddish-speaking Jew, you might as well just read my book to learn proper German. But his main audience were German-speaking Christians interested ultimately in learning Hebrew.
And that then brings me to your fifth chapter, where you talk about another text, which is the Gabine story. And I believe you've published on this in Arthuriana. And I want you to maybe tell me a bit, as someone who doesn't work with medieval and early modern materials, what are some of the challenges and perhaps also the rewards of working with medieval source materials when you don't have perhaps a complete text, for example?
Thank you. Yeah, the Gabine is really something that I'm proud of, because it's a fairly forgotten text. It's in an appendix to an early 20th century collection of Wiedewald stories. And it's just such a strange and fascinating Arthurian text that I was very happy that I got the chance to translate it into English. This is an article in Arthuriana with some introduction to it. I know there's some advertisement, but I'm really, I feel like here I was actually doing a service to this tradition and to also our discipline. I mean, if for class you need a very strange Arthurian text, go and find this article, Teach Gabine. More people need to know Gabine and work on this very strange text. With limitations, the working on it, as you hinted, because we actually do not have the Yiddish text. Some people would say Yiddish question mark, because it's a strange text. The language is completely strange. We know it was printed in Hebrew letters, but it's preserved only in transliteration. We can trace a little bit the text and the text history, but we're incredibly limited in accessing this text. There's the front page, and I think the last page of the text are actually also preserved as a copy in a journal, but mostly we have this transliterated text of something that doesn't even look like Yiddish, or that just looks strange. It's also not German. So it's hard to deal with a text when you can't even identify its language, let alone actually have the source at hand. So there are always limitations in how to interpret it, what context is it from. There are some theories aligning it with a pietist movement that also impacted the Jews of the 18th century. But it leaves us with more questions just textually than we have answers. At the same time, it is actually fascinatingly dedicated to Prussian King Frederick Wilhelm II. And it's a really Prussian text somehow. So it includes court ceremonial that you would find in Prussia. It follows up on the fascination with China of the time. Yeah, I should have said, so Garbein is actually Garbein. So it's the Widowild story, but it focuses a little bit more on the storyline concerning Widowild's father, Garbein, the most famous of all knights. See the recent Green Knight movie with Dave Patel. That's Garbein for you. So Garbein, most famous of Arthurian knights, probably in a competition with Lancelot, but famous. He's the father. And here we have a text where Garbein travels through many countries, Russia. He visits Sardinia and ends up in China and ultimately actually becomes the new emperor of China. When I read it the first time, I was like, what? What just happened? And was also very excited of having found such a spectacular text. So we have an Arthurian knight in a Yiddish text who becomes the emperor of China. So many, amazing things basically been happening already. But it's really hard to reconstruct the actual context. Are there other sources for this text? So in my field, we work with a lot of question marks, right? And one way to work with that is just having reference texts that we say like, okay, I don't know how they're really related, but this is sort of my big reference because at some point they are related or somehow they are related. I cannot tell you exactly how, but Widowild is clearly related to Garbein. I cannot give you all the stages, the steps in between. But sometimes this is also freeing because it really allows you to focus on the text as such without considering all the time, how is the model in this section or how does the model text approach this question? So it's also sometimes really freeing. And sometimes when I, hear colleagues who are really dealing with contemporary authors who then publish new things and these texts or these new publications basically destroy earlier scholarly articles that were written about living contemporaneous authors or contemporary authors, I think I don't even have a name for authorship. So it's nice to not have that problem.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned also how you encourage the teaching of this text that's a bit less known. And I was wondering if you could also tell us a bit about how you bring your work from this book into your teaching and bringing both medieval and early modern German literature with Old Yiddish literature and showing their entanglements.
I have to do another advertisement. I'm sorry. There's actually an MLA book coming out, one of the great MLA teaching series on teaching the Arthurian tradition. And I wrote an article for that collection on how to teach sort of the Jewish tradition and with some ideas how to teach the Yiddish, the Hebrew text. I think Garbein is just great because it's different, it's strange. And it's such a unique text that it's okay if students don't know everything surrounding the Arthurian tradition or something like this, because, we are a long way from the medieval Arthurian romances by this point, also in the way the text is constructed. And I like it. It's a short text. It's 12 pages in the appendix to this 20th century collection. So it's a very short text. You can quickly read the whole text. And it ties into ideas of colonialism. There's this sort of idea expansion, exoticism, sort of there's a big fascination and sort of exoticizing of China as sort of now new, basically fantastic realm for this audience. For its late 18th century audience. And so the text lends itself very well to bring Arthur into contemporary discussion, sort of what do stories still mean to us? How do stories create otherness, identity, represent outsiderdom, other groups? How can we also bring in discussions, you know, about post-colonialism, diversity into our reading of texts that are older, that are not from our times. So I like particularly teaching this short text, but I also try, of course, in my King Arthur class to bring in, for example, Widuwild, or there's a Hebrew text, sometimes called an anti-Arthurian romance, a medieval Hebrew Arthur fragment that deals more with the downfall of the Arthurian realm. But things like this, just to show my students an alternative narrative to majority culture storytelling, and to show, well, somehow the story was so fascinating that a lot of different groups interacted with it and made it their own and thought it's worth continuing to tell it and listen to it.
Fascinating. And I imagine you're able to do this at different levels of language, and both undergraduate and graduate students.
Yeah, exactly. And sort of like sometimes in English translation, I mean, almost exclusively English translation, but it's of course a very different tradition in a graduate seminar on King Arthur and in an undergraduate seminar, although, most of my graduate students are not medievalists, right? Or don't take that many medieval classes. So it's also nice in that regard that they don't bring too much expectation or understanding to the table and have sort of like a very free approach to the material.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Well, I would want to take one of your classes. So one of my final questions then is, what are you working on next now that you've finished this big project? What's piquing your curiosity? Anything in the works right now?
Thank you. That's a great question. I was a little bit afraid, you know, letting go of Widuwild. There's so many Widuwild, Vigeloy's adaptations. It's a whole universe, and we spend so much time with each other that I was a little bit scared, you know, leaving this behind and thinking, what's next? And just through rereading some old Yiddish texts, preparing, well, conference presentations and other events, I got really interested in the construction of otherness, a classic topic in early modern medieval German literature studies. But I noticed that, of course, we don't have so much the heathen. Well, so in the Christian text, we often have like the heathens as the others, the Jews as sort of like complicated others. And there's a whole discourse around them. The Jewish texts or the old Yiddish texts that I've been looking at don't really have that so much, but they have often one fantastic creature that combines all sort of like otherness attributes. So I really got interested in that and think this is going to shape up to sort of like a project of otherness in these texts. In addition to that, the great Bovebuch, which in itself is part of a long adaptation tradition, the Ortierisch Bovebuch, deals a lot with race and otherness. And if you know medieval studies, maybe you know that there's currently, or for the past few years, a huge increase in discussing race and racism in medieval studies. Can we call it race? Can we call it racism when we talk about medieval literature? And there's a big push to use racism in the context of these medieval studies when we consider sort of like physical and physical othering, all sort of in a power discourse. And I noticed that the old Yiddish texts are actually maybe not as inclusive as one might think, or as we often falsely assume it's a minority culture, right? They are tolerant. They are they're happy to include people from far away that look very different. And here I found some texts now that are fairly dismissive of people they reference as Black, that they also create as like others, often also in the context of Islam. And this is in the context of medieval, an early modern Ashkenaz. So I think we have different regions where this discourse would be quite different. But so I've been starting to slowly sort of get into more research on the construction of race and otherness in these old Yiddish texts, and to see sort of like how is sort of the identity then out of the hero shaped and created, and what is it that it's created against. And I think this will probably, yeah, also turn into a huge project with probably more than a book. But I'm very excited. I'm so at the beginning of new research, and I feel really the enthusiasm of going into a completely new and very different area of old Yiddish literature and its interactions with the German literature.
Fascinating. Well, I can't wait to see the many articles and conference papers and eventually perhaps a book that will come out of this. So thank you so much for sharing with us about your newest book and about your research today and also about your teaching. And I wish you all the best luck in the future and look forward to talking to you soon.
Thank you so much, Leah.